At the end of May and in early June, dismissed ministry workers and former Iraqi army soldiers held a series of demonstrations. Some vowed they would violently oppose the U.S. decisions. "All of us will become suicide bombers," former officer Kyrie Jassim told Reuters. The wire service article was distributed at the CPA, with that quotation highlighted. "The only thing left for me is to blow myself up in the face of tyrants," another officer told Al Jazeera. Bremer insisted he wouldn't be moved. "We are not going to be blackmailed into producing programs because of threats of terrorism," he said at a press conference in early June. The protests continued. On June 18, an estimated 2,000 Iraqi soldiers gathered outside the Green Zone to denounce the dissolution decision. Some carried signs that said, "Please keep your promises." Others threw rocks. "We will take up arms," Tahsin Ali Hussein vowed in a speech to the demonstrators, according to an account by Agence France-Presse. "We are all very well-trained soldiers and we are armed. We will start ambushes, bombings, and even suicide bombings. We will not let the Americans rule us in such a humiliating way." U.S. soldiers fired into the crowd, killing two. In the weeks after that, U.S. commanders grew increasingly concerned by the unrest the order caused. At about this time, General Sanchez was formally promoted from commander of the 1st Armored Division to commander of 5 Corps, the headquarters for all U.S. military operations in Iraq. At the reception after the change of command ceremony, Major General Petraeus confronted Walt Slocum. "The failure to pay ex-officers was getting U.S. troops hurt," he warned Slocum. "And the longer the demobilized Iraqi soldiers were left hanging, the more dangerous they would become." "They are really tinder out there just waiting for a spark," Petraeus told him, who then promised to press the issue. A few days later, Rumsfeld approved the payment, and the officers' protests ended. Perhaps just as significant as those two controversial moves of Bremer's was his third major decision. There wouldn't be an Iraqi government anytime soon, despite Garner's plan to set one up. "It simply was not possible," he later said. Bremer also soon began pursuing a program aimed at moving Iraq toward a free market economy, beginning by shutting down unprofitable state-run industries. This had the political effect of further alienating the middle class, which already had been hit by debathification, and which was full of managers from those inefficient industries. The combination of all these moves, a prolonged foreign occupation that was built on debathification, dissolution of the military, and economic upheaval, radically undercut social stability and built opposition to the American presence. "What we have done over the last 6 months in Al-Anbar has been a recipe for instability," Keith Mines would write in a November memo. "Through aggressive debathification, the demobilization of the army, and the closing of factories, the coalition has left tens of thousands of individuals outside the economic and political life of the country." It didn't take long for Iraqi resentment to become palpable. Major Christopher Varhola, a reservist trained as an anthropologist, recalled being at a meeting in the Green Zone in late May 2003 between Ambassador Hume Horan, a senior CPA official, and a group of about 270 tribal leaders. The general mood was one of impatience with the American effort, and a suspicion that it was intentionally slow. Varhola recalled, "Sheikh Munter Aboud of Amara began by thanking Horan for the removal of Saddam Hussein. But," he continued, "he needed to know if the United States believed itself to be an occupier or a liberator. Horan, an honest man, replied that he believed the U.S. was somewhere in between those two approaches. If America was a liberator, then we were welcome indefinitely as guests," the Sheikh responded, according to notes of the meeting. He stated, however, that if we were occupiers, then he and his descendants would die resisting us. This met with energetic applause from the audience. Then, about one quarter of those present, about 65 of the Iraqis at the meeting, stood and walked out. Late in the spring of 2003, an army officer filling an intelligence position in Baghdad began using some of the Iraqi exiles assigned to him to conduct a quiet survey of what was being said in mosques on Fridays. He was worried that there was little unbiased, systematic reporting of Iraqi public sentiment, which he thought needed tracking. In addition, He thought it was important to get a handle on the structure of the clergy and of the alliances between them. Wanting to share his results, he went over one day and mentioned his reporting system to the communications people at CPA. They weren't interested and told him, "That's tactical. Take it to the Army." So he sought out an Army colonel who read the reports eagerly and focused on anti-American comments made in one sermon. The colonel told the officer that the offending cleric must be arrested. The officer protested. All the religious leaders were anti-American, at least in their rhetoric. "You can't survive as a cleric if you don't denounce the Americans," the officer explained. The key, he thought, was to distinguish between those clerics who settled for using only words and those who advocated violence. Worried that additional reporting could provoke more arrest orders, as well as endanger the Iraqis gathering the information, the intelligence officer shut down his collection network.